Really glad to have you all with us today. We're feeling, or I should say, I'm feeling rested and ready to go straight through the runoff election. As many of you who listen to the show regularly know, we took the 4th of July off, but we also took Friday the 6th off to give us a break, but also to give you a chance to just get away from politics for just a few days. So I hope you're back with us and you're as ready as we are to take on the political scene in Georgia and in Washington in the weeks ahead. With that in mind, a couple quick program notes before I introduce the panel and start talking about the stories we want to cover today. Remember that in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from today, July 23rd, we start our new four-day-a-week schedule. We will be on the air Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. Thursday will continue to be a two-way street day. But we hope you'll join us. And, of course, that first Tuesday, the 24th, is the day of the primary runoff. So we're excited about that and hope you'll be with us for our four-day-a-week show. Remember, too, that you can watch us in the studio here if you just go to the GPB News Facebook page, Facebook Live. We'll give you a chance to watch the show, and we love it when you leave your comments there. If you're not don't want to do it that way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. All right, we have a great full house today. I'm excited about the show that we're going to bring you today. Jim Galloway is off today. We had to bring in one of the real heavy hitters to fill his considerable shoes, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Kevin Riley. Hi, Kevin. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Bill.
Are you writing Galloway's column while he's gone?
No, they wouldn't put that in my hands.
All right. Well, we're awfully glad you're here. Sitting right next to you is one of your top political reporters, Greg Bluestein. He, of course, reports on all things about state politics, spending an awful lot of time right now covering the gubernatorial campaign. You read him in the Dead Tree edition of the AJC, but also at Political Insider, part of Politically Georgia at my AJC. And Greg, you've got a podcast.
Politically Georgia podcast. It was out today. We go over the week's biggest news in Georgia politics, all the shenanigans under the Gold Dome and around the state.
Heath Garrett is with it. Heath, I think Bluestein's trying to kind of horn in on the radio business here. Maybe I ought to be looking over my shoulder.
We got to be paying attention to these guys.
Heath Garrett, of course, a Republican political strategist and longtime advisor to Senator Johnny Isaacson, among others. Where do you have candidates in this cycle?
I've got them in Alabama, Georgia. We've got them in Maryland, Arkansas, all over the country.
All over the country. Terrific. State Representative Brenda Lopez is with us today. She's just finished your first term in the Georgia legislature. Your district is largely Gwinnett County or partially Gwinnett County, Brenda?
It's actually all in Gwinnett County. So
okay.
Very excited to finish up the first term and get back come January.
How'd that go?
It went, it's an experience, and I look forward to again, come next year after this election cycle. It's going to determine a lot of things that happen under the Gold Dome.
Well, we're glad you're here. One of the reasons I'm glad you're here, Brenda, is you obviously represent a county that is changing as dramatically as any geographic area across the entire South.
Absolutely. I think that Gwinnett is definitely the bellwether of where the state is, not where it's changing, because people keep saying that Georgia's changing. In fact, it has already changed. It's just, Gwinnett with its concentration and its population size, I think it's an indication of where our state is going to head.
All right. And back by popular demand. You know, buddy, if too many days go by without you being on this show, listeners start contacting me to say, where's Buddy Darden? Well, here you are, former Democratic congressman from Cobb County, Buddy Darden. Hi, Buddy.
And I want to thank my wife, Lillian, for always reminding you to ask me to come down here.
All right. We got a lot to talk about. Let's start with gubernatorial news. You know, we did go through a you know, the 4th of July thing slowed down just a little bit that week. It wasn't as active as usual, although there was a TV debate between Brian Kemp and Casey Cagle in Columbus the other night. We can talk a little bit about what emerged there. But let's look at the latest news coming out of the campaign. Greg, let me start with you. Brian Kemp and Casey Cagle have been in a fairly fierce battle to own their support for the Second Amendment. Cagle got a little bit of an edge on Kemp over this when he won the endorsement of the NRA some time ago. Now the NRA is stepping up. You all reported this morning in the AJC that Oliver North, the new president of NRA, Oliver North of Iran-Contra fame, is actually coming in this weekend, I think, to campaign for Cagle.
He is. He'll be here Saturday on an all-day series of events, one in Savannah, one in Kennesaw, and one up in Gainesville in Cagle's hometown at a fish fry. And this is a very important time for Casey Cagle. Early voting has started. He's trying to keep the momentum that he says he's built. He's trying to keep that going. And Oliver North will be a draw. He'll be able to talk about the NRA and its priorities and be there to remind voters that the NRA has picked Lieutenant Governor Cagle as their top Republican for this office.
Heath, how important is both the endorsement of the NRA and appearances by Oliver North in driving Republican voters to the polls for the runoff election?
It's hard to underestimate or overestimate, actually, in this case, the importance of this. The endorsement's huge. And the NRA endorses in a lot of races around the country. But to add to that, bringing in your brand new president, who is a Fox News icon, somebody who the base probably has 95 to 100% name recognition with, and to have him in three major kind of media markets, in the middle of early voting, it's a big deal for Republican primary voters.
Heath, I just have to ask, I mean, is North doing this elsewhere or only in Georgia?
I'm not aware of him doing it elsewhere. He may be doing it, but this may be one of his first major trips as president. And so it's being viewed inside Republican circles as a big deal for not only for Casey Cagle, but for the introduction of a new president like this.
Well, I also have to assume that what we expect to be a very low turnout for that runoff, that any way you can get anything to motivate voters, you take advantage of, because so few votes can determine who wins that thing. So this is good for Casey Cagle, yes.
But it might work both ways. You know, I can't remember where Oliver North was either pardoned or whether he beat the rap on appeal. But in any event, he is not universally regarded quite as highly as I think Heath claims that he is.
Well, for the Republican runoff, it's definitely, I think, good in terms of what you're talking about, increasing the turnout. Now, it's still absolutely very low, but interestingly enough, this runoff election actually has garnered more people coming out to vote than even the primary cycle did. So, and that you've seen both on the Republican and the Democratic runoff tickets.
So, it's hard for me, Kevin, to get a real handle on just how low this turnout could be. You know, I ask you, as the editor of the AJC, you keep pretty good track of what people are reading when they come to your newspaper. What's the interest level in the stories about this politics in the state of Georgia right now?
We see a lot of interest. I think that people, I mean, we can obviously get a feel for that based on our website statistics and things. But, I mean, it's obvious to me the gloves are off. I mean, so some people are just checking every day, and it's almost like, what will they do next? You know, we've got a new secret recording out. We've got all kinds of charges and countercharges. And, you know, people love blood sport. I mean, that's really what we have.
Well, and that's what runoffs bring, right? Casey Cagle initially was going to be above the fray, or that was the idea, that was the consideration, that he was the moderate voice. And something that he said about being both Trump and deal, like, you can't have both. Those are like water and oil.
Yeah, that's a good point, Greg, that Brenda makes.
Yeah, I mean, there can't be there's hard to be any more two dissimilar politicians than President Trump or Governor Deal, aside from their party affiliation. But this debate you mentioned in Columbus was a good reminder of how Cagle has really abandoned the above the fray strategy. He abandoned it late in the primary cycle, where he really started pummeling Hunter Hill to try to shape the race for who he would face in the runoff, and he picked Brian Kemp. And, you know, with polls showing this race this tight, and by the way, we're going to have an AJC poll out later this week, the first media poll we've seen in the runoff cycle. We've had a few internal polls and a few private polls showing the race deadlocked, but we're going to have an AJC poll. But with polls showing it this tight, it might have been to Cagle's peril. We'll see.
Let's be clear when you say that the Cagle campaign picked Brian Kemp. They did everything they could to drive down votes for Hunter Hill,
yep,
who they really were nervous about facing in the runoff. They thought Brian Kemp, and in fact, there's a story today that speaks to what they think about Brian Kemp as being too much a wild card who voters would not go for, Heath.
No, that's exactly right. There was a little bit of shaping of the race, right? And it was actually Hunter Hill and Clay Tippins, right? There was a hit on both of them to make sure they didn't get any more traction. And then to get it into a runoff between two people who have a record in politics, and anytime you have a record, you want your opponent to have a record as well. And so Brian Kemp having a record has allowed it to get into that normal political jostling that we're seeing now.
And then you add this other factor to it, and as much as it pains me to say this, whoever wins that runoff is probably going to be the next governor of Georgia. So the stakes
why do you say that?
Even higher.
Wait. Why do you go there already?
Well, first
you're
of all,
you're a Democrat.
I am, and we're being pummeled on the left by the likes of Maxine Waters and others. And if the Democrats could just keep their mouth shut and let the Republicans fight. But, oh, no, we've got to get out there. We've got to get out there and make some noise ourselves and talk about sandblasting Stone Mountain and that kind of thing. But we just need to sit back and let the Republicans do their thing. But we're not doing a very
good
job of it.
And, Brenda, there in a nutshell, Buddy Darden expresses the entire dilemma that Democrats, your colleagues, are facing as they move toward November. Which wing of the party? Is it the progressive Democrats? Is it the more moderate Democrats? There's going to be a huge fight over that this fall.
And I think it's a healthy fight. And I don't think that that's a problem. I don't think that there's one wing or not. It we've always said, right, big tent. And we have to remember that. Now, it's an uphill battle. And for me, it's not the issues. It's not the message. The reason that it's an uphill battle, but I think that we do have a winnable chance for the governors, speaking specifically about the governors with Stacey Abrams, is strategy and tactics, not messaging. And so, you know, something that Abrams has said frequently, right, the reason that we have that possibility is simple math. And so I think that our issues, our concerns with our messaging and, you know, what spectrum within the Democratic Party is most vocal, I think it's the same issues that the Republicans side has and why you see in runoff elections, you know, what was mentioned, right, the battle of the craziness and who's going to be the craziest out there. And so I think that we both parties have these issues. But at the end of the day, it's turnout.
Yeah.
Well, Brenda has a very good point, except to say it's not the turnout that's going to make the difference of the partisans. It's the turnout that's going to make the difference of the people out there in the middle, of the people who are generally call themselves independents. They may vote Republican, they may vote Democrat, but they consider themselves independent, and that is who is going to determine the winner of this election, in my opinion.
We really don't have that issue in Georgia this fall about which wing the Democrat is affiliating herself with. I mean, she has decided unabashedly to be on the very liberal side of the Democratic Party.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
that's
right.
I'm proud of my intellectually honest Democratic friend here, Buddy Darden, who nailed it. I mean, the independent vote in the middle, which is a growing segment of our electorate, even in this hyper-politicized environment that we're in, does tend to be center-right in the state of Georgia. So they may not like some of the social issues on the right of the Republican Party, but they're definitely not in line with the Elizabeth Warrens and the Nancy Pelosi's of the Democratic Party.
Greg Bluestein, if we were doing this show at a New York NPR station in the weeks before the primary, congressional primary there, we would have been saying the same thing about Joe Crowley, longtime Democratic incumbent, maybe moving toward becoming Speaker if Democrats took control, right. And he is beaten by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is from that very progressive wing of the party. And what that argues, I think, is the possibility that a liberal Democrat in this case, Abrams, believes she can energize enough voters with that message in an entirely new way in this state, yes?
Yeah, and Republicans are hoping that the same fight that they went through in 2010 with the Tea Party movement and more establishment mainstream Republicans will unfold in the Democratic primary, but in the Democratic race, I should say, within the party. But what we saw in the primary was that both candidates, you know, Stacey Evans started as sort of more moderate, but then she moved far to the party's left. And, you know, Stacey Abrams tried to outflank her at every point, and she wins with 76% of the vote. So I don't know how much of an internal struggle there is, but we know will happen on both sides is whoever the Republican candidate that emerges will try to paint Stacey Abrams as an extremist.
Yeah.
And they'll try to, and she'll try to do the same thing to them.
Just to clarify, absolutely. I was talking about the National Democratic Party is facing these kinds of challenges moving
right.
forward.
And that's what I was going to mention. We're still in Georgia, and regardless of what you mentioned about painting the Democratic ticket as too liberal, the reality is that it's not. We're in Georgia. And if you look at, you know, I was looking at Governor Deal's website, and if you look at his legacy issues, which are education, transportation, infrastructure, criminal justice reform, juvenile justice reform, reentry programs, health care, economic development, natural resources, those were all listed. Well, guess what? Those are all the same issues and topics that Stacey Abrams actually has detailed plans on continuing that good policy in the state of Georgia.
Heath Garrett was nodding with you until you got to the Stacey Abrams line.
Right, because we left out we're going to raise taxes and increase regulation on all Georgians, which is a part of the Democratic platform.
Wait a minute. What do you mean it's part of the platform?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the policies that the Democratic Party and Stacey Abrams proposes, it's going to require increases in taxes on the state, and that's the number one
fair
issue.
Enough, right? Fair enough.
She said she wants to reverse the income tax cut.
Right.
That would be
absolutely. That does not. We have a microphone. That is the case. But again, if you're talking about the pocketbooks of the average Georgian, they are not actually benefiting from those tax cuts. And, you know, being in the state legislature and in the legislature and seeing tax credits left and right for major corporations, that is not to the benefit of the average Georgian.
All right, except for Delta, you mean. Tax
right.
credits, except for Delta.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about a couple issues that, Kevin, you all had in the AJC this morning. We already mentioned the fact that we got Oliver North heading here for Casey Cagle. But there's two stories that popped this morning on the Political Insider blog. One of them, it is a continuation of a story that you all broke not too long ago, which suggests that Brian Kemp was backing away from possibly intervening and sanctioning in some way a guy who ran two massage envy operations. There had been allegations of inappropriate sexual touching in these places. And the AJC piece, I don't remember who the byline was,
Johnny Edwards.
And you were involved in it too, Greg. So let me go to you first. You start the piece by saying that Brian Kemp showed up to talk with the man who runs those two. And you say, but he wasn't there to start a disciplinary process. He was there to raise money. Talk about the story.
Yeah, he hosted a fundraiser for Brian Kemp, and he's one of a range of individuals and corporations who have given to Kemp's campaign, even though they're directly under his office's oversight. And this was a sort of, a standout example because this massage envy chain of businesses have been hit with all these sexual harassment complaints, and no action has been taken against them. And so what we have over the weekend, and I had to do some catch-up last night after I got back from vacation, but over the weekend, you had State Senator Renee Unnerman, a Cagle supporter, and Barry Morgan, a Solicitor General from Cobb County, another Cagle supporter, both call on respectively BJ Pack, U.S. Attorney, and AG Chris Carr to open investigations into why Kemp did not pursue legal action against this massage chain, and saying that basically, in Renee Unnerman's words, it was quid pro quo. Now, the likelihood of this happening is very small, but it is a way for them to parry accusations from Kemp supporters.
I thought one of the most fascinating aspects of this, Heath, was in response to Renee Unnerman, Kemp spokesman Ryan Mahoney called her mentally unstable. Renee Unnerman is one of the Republican leaders of the state Senate, and to use that kind of language to go after her is, I think, tells us the influence of Trump on how we talk politics.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think this is a good example that in the modern era, you know, Trump, with the Trump mentality is you, if you're hit, you hit back hard or dirtier. So what I say, it's just the importation of New York style of politics, along with all of our friends from New York moving here.
I have to ask Buddy and Heath and Brenda. I mean, so we reported this story as part of a larger story and part of investigative journalism we've been doing around inappropriate sexual behavior in certain professions, including doctors, massage therapists, and others. But really, Kemp's comeback and position is, we don't want to overregulate anybody, and that's as the chief regulator in the state. So my question is, do you think this hurts or helps him with the people he's got to convince to vote for him right now?
Really, Kemp's comeback.
I'm sorry. I've got to
overregulate.
Excuse me. I've got my volume turned on, so I'm hearing feedback on the show. Somebody respond to what Kevin just asked.
Yeah, I think that right now we're in that last bit of the silly season of a campaign where it's just kind of one ethics complaint against another, and they're all throwing it out there. At a certain point in time for the average voter, what happens here, unless one of these complaints gets some kind of traction much beyond the normal story or two, it just becomes clutter, and they start to discount it as one campaign is feeding reporters the other. And that's what seems to be happening here in the last 2 weeks. So I don't know that this it does clutter. It probably helps Cagle a little bit because it muddies the water, and it looks like every time he charges Cagle with something, Kemp's got his own problems. But I don't know, but before the 2 weeks from tomorrow, this is going to really make or break the campaign.
Yeah, buddy, I find it hard to imagine this is going to change too many primary runoff votes.
Regrettably, I'll have to agree with Heath on this because there's been so much back and forth now. And that unless it has a specific ring to it, I don't think it's going to make a whole lot of difference.
Absolutely. What's going to matter is going off to the general election and the fact that you're going to be able to refresh these accusations. And so I think that that's where the real impact is going to come.
And as a former member of the Ethics Commission, I do point out that this does raise an interesting legislative question longer term, right? If you are regulating these entities, right, where's the right role? Because that's what this opens up to. If you're receiving money, that runs right up against our First Amendment rights to receive money because money is political speech in the modern context. So I think some interesting policy debates there.
All right, I got to get to a break. As I do, we've been getting a number of tweets. For instance, Richard L. Boder says, Buddy hit the nail on the head. The GOP has been shooting itself in the foot. The Democrats seem to be shoving their feet in the path. Todd Rehm says to give his best to you, Uncle Buddy, since you're not on Twitter yourself. We have Laquan Banks, and I hope I've said your first name right, Laquan, says, yippee, it's 2 p.m. She's obviously glad that Political Rewind is back, so we appreciate that. Let's get a break in. There's one more story in the GOP gubernatorial race that I'd love to get to after the break, and then we're going to talk a little bit about how Stacey Abrams is preparing for the general election. This is Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Political Rewind, full house, which has been fun today. We've got State Representative Brenda Lopez from Gwinnett County. We've got Heath Garrett, Republican consultant. It's Monday. You were on vacation last week, so it's great to have you back on this Monday show.
Well, I'm great. You're glad to be back. Spent a little time out west.
Buddy Darden, your fellow Cobb Countyite, sitting right next to you, former member of the U.S. House, Greg Bluestein and Kevin Riley from the AJC. Kevin Riley, of course, is the boss. So Bluestein is being particularly well-behaved
The boss
today.
Is boss's boss.
All right, let's do a couple more gubernatorial items. Another item that popped in the AJC this morning was we've talked probably too much about this secret recording that Clay Tippins made of a conversation he had with Casey Cagle. It got a lot of news. It was a pretty significant story. Casey Cagle essentially Greg, how would you characterize
it? He said he supported what he can his quote, bad public policy to undercut Hunter Hill, who was a rival in that race.
Politics trumped policy is what it comes down to. Now, another portion of that conversation, which was secretly recorded, has been released. Greg, I'll allow you to talk about it, but this strikes me as a fairly weak effort to try to extend the conversation. In it, Cagle basically says this primary felt like it was who had the biggest gun, who had the biggest truck, and who could be the craziest. Now, one way to interpret that is that, you know, he's calling the whole race crazy, but he's commenting on the kind of campaign Brian Kemp ran. What's wrong with that?
And that's exactly what Scott Binkley, the Cagle campaign manager, said in a pretty lengthy statement, which said, keep on talking about that. You're talking about yourself. But also bear in mind the timing of this. Today is a big day in the electoral cycle because it's the day that campaign finances are supposed to be released. And odds are Cagle's campaign will way outraise Kemp's campaign because they have throughout this entire race. And so it was also an attempt to lengthen the story, extend the story, and also sort of maybe distract attention away from whatever financials come out later today.
Okay.
I'd add to that, it actually contradicts the earlier hit. I mean, he's complaining about the fact there's not enough policy being discussed in the in the recording. So you got one hit out there saying he did something political, not policy, and then you got in the same recording now saying, I think there needs to be more policy discussed.
Yeah, so I've got to say, buddy, if I were the Kemp campaign, I would do everything I could to continue to showcase this secret recording. So, you know, fair play for them. It's just this isn't quite as significant as the other one was.
Absolutely. And even though this goes on all the time, and even though Casey Cagle has been outed, a lot of people don't even realize it. You've got to tell them one time what you told them again and again and again and again, because some people have, I promise you, have never even heard of this. So tell them over and over. I learned that trying cases before a jury. You tell the jury what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. So you got to do it over and over again.
I'm just worried because early on I met with Clay Tippins, and I don't know if he recorded it or not. I'm trying to remember.
Well, that last recording was just a recording of the facts. So that's, I guess, what makes it less bad.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to start seeing Kemp leverage this recording even more, not just with statements, but we haven't really seen this yet. But so far in his campaign ad, it kind of nodded toward it, but it didn't focus on it. I think we'll see his next campaign ad really seize on this.
Well, and he did, am I correct? You wrote about the debate in Columbus. He went after this in that debate, which is what leads you to believe that they're going to really maybe emphasize that in ads coming up.
Yeah, he highlighted it in his closing in the debate. And in that first campaign ad, he talked about Cagle's quote-unquote corruption scandal. But again, to that point, I mean, it's permeated the metro Atlanta market. I don't know how much it's permeated Republican voters in South Georgia or North Georgia. And I think they're really going to go after that.
And let me take up what Brenda said just a little while ago. When we get to the general election, let's assume just for a second that Brian Kemp wins. We're going to see this Brian Kemp mucks things up quite a bit in the general election, aren't we, Brenda?
That's right. And then something that Greg mentioned, I was in Vidalia and a couple of places down over a weekend. And from the folks that we spoke, and then just from visibility in terms of signage and such, you know, still it was Cagle everywhere, anywhere.
It was Cagle.
Everywhere and anywhere that I drove around that Vidalia, Tombs, Lyons kind of area, that's all I saw.
Well, and I think that y'all both alluded to something, Greg and Bill, that we need to pay attention to. We got to pay attention to the financial disclosures tonight. Brian Kemp has been at a money disadvantage the entire primary. If he is at a disadvantage and he only has enough money to either be all negative, if he can run one message statewide, which costs probably $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, if he can only run one message, is he going to be all negative on Cagle to keep Cagle down, or is it going to be positive? Because if you start splitting that baby, you've muddled your message, and that's the tough choice, it sounds like to me, Kemp's going to have to make here.
But what's interesting about that, Kevin, Greg, is that the message that got Kemp as far as it did was these two rather playful, spots. The first one where he challenges an alleged boyfriend of of his daughter. It holds a shotgun up and basically says, you better treat her right, and you believe in gun rights and all that. And then he has the second one where he blows up something and takes off in his pickup truck to go after undocumented immigrants.
I think that puts him in a tough spot because, I mean, they're both trying to be the pro-gun guy. So it's like that's nullified, that effort, because they're sort of not enough differentiation there. And so now, as I think Keith's pointing out, is he's got to find a way to differentiate himself, and it looks like he's chosen this recording.
Greg, it's what Heath is saying, I think, is we've heard all we're going to hear from Brian Kemp about, yep, I just said that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be interested to see what their next ad is, because we've seen his poll numbers rise from the 20s to the 40s, whereas Cagle's numbers have kind of plateaued since the May primary. So he's already seen the secret recording, and you know the sort of outflanking movement to the right has already helped them. So I think we're going to see more of that.
Right. Cagle wishes the vote was today, right?
Remember the last gubernatorial runoff on the Republican side between Nathan Deal and Kieran Handel, only 2,500 votes difference.
Yeah. Right. But after a primary in which Karen Handel basically shellacked Nathan Deal, showing us the dangers of getting yourself into a runoff when you shouldn't have to.
That's right. And one thing that I want to point out is that most of us here, and probably those that are on the radio, if they're listening, they care and they know about what's going on in the news. But again, the average voter that's going to come out, and one of the reasons these videos work is it's name ID, name recognition, and just remember somebody's name at the end of the day, what policies they did or didn't do. Sometimes it isn't as doesn't have the same fruit as simply having the name being heard somewhere. So that's why these tactics work.
All right, let's move on. I said we'd talk about Stacey Abrams. She's, of course, already won the Democratic nomination for governor. Greg, she had her best reporting period. Yeah, they got their numbers out early, quickly, probably because they wanted to be in the clear to make the point, right?
Oh, yeah.
They wanted to command the headline. 2,756,000 dollars. That's a big haul for Stacey Abrams. That's April 1st, June 30th.
Exactly, and almost as important to the number of cash on hand they have, which is double the last they had the last reporting.
$1.5 million.
Around $1.5 million. And a lot of the criticism from other Democrats against her was that her burn rate. She had burned through 77% of her campaign cash, 80% at one point. So she is stockpiling because she hasn't had to spend it. She hasn't had to go spend on a lot of advertising or direct mail right now because she's enjoying the Republicans scrapping against each other. And so she's able to sort of consolidate, raise money. I bet once the full report comes out, we're going to see a lot of that money comes from out of state. Not maybe Ossoff. Ossoff had about 90-something percent of his money from out of state. I don't think it will be that high. It will be a lot of out-of-state money. But she sort of owned it. She said, yeah, I have no problem raising money from out of state. This is a Georgia campaign with national roots.
Heath, it's interesting that Greg mentioned Ossoff because, of course, Ossoff did raise an enormous amount of money from national Democratic interests, and it didn't do him as much good as he would have hoped in his race against Karen Handel.
Now, that'll absolutely be a part of this campaign. You know, number one, where's her money coming from? And even though she's reduced her burn rate from burning 70% of it, she still has a pretty high burn rate, 2.75 raised, and only have 1.6 cash on hand. That's a pretty expensive way to raise money. But she is a national candidate. There's no question that the Republican nominee, whoever it is going to be able to make an issue out of that, saying that the Nancy Pelosi's, the Elizabeth Warren's, are going to try to own Georgia by owning the governor's mansion with somebody who's much farther to the left than the average
voter. I love, Brenda, the fact that he's just brought up the magic names, Nancy Pelosi.
That's right. And I think that for Abrams race, really, again, you can keep saying that just because they're words to say, but that does not actually, that doesn't pan out with Abrams. She's been in the legislature. She's done all of her work here, all of her grassroots efforts, both in her capital access nonprofits, the voter registration. It's all Georgia. Very different from John Ossoff, which really we didn't know, you know, who he was prior to running.
And he didn't live in the district.
That aside, but this is different. You know, Stacey Abrams is a Georgia politician. And money coming from elsewhere, it's not coming in those like massive amounts of money. And the fact is that one of the things that bothers me in certain ways is that this is a governor's race. We want to be a state that is known in our country. We want to have national influence as the state of Georgia. So I don't understand how it would ever be negative that we have a governor, whomever our governor might be, that can actually highlight our state throughout the country internationally. That's a good thing.
I don't want to be discourteous to my friend Heath or to my friend, new friend Brenda, but I'm going to say that what they just said really doesn't matter, in my opinion, because both candidates, both campaigns are going to be awash with cash. There's going to be plenty of money out there for all these consultants like Heath and all these people, all these people like my friend Todd Ream. There's going to be money everywhere for all. There's going to be plenty for my friend Bobby Kahn. There's going to be money everywhere coming out of the trees. So money will not be an issue. Both sides will get it from the national. Both sides will get it from questionable sources. Both sides will get it from a situation where they can criticize each other that won't matter in the end.
You know, Kevin, this is an aside, but I think it's a relevant time to bring it up. I am always amused and a bit troubled by all of the stories that pop up here and there throughout an election cycle from the news media about how disgraceful it is that there's so much money in politics, how much it now takes to run a race. I don't mind it when it comes from the newspaper so much, but when the TV stations start running those stories, given that they're the ones who are charging they charge for commercials, it seems just a touch bit hypocritical.
Yeah, it's going to be a good year for Georgia TV stations. I think that's, in the final analysis, what Buddy's saying. And I think Brenda has a point, too, which is, in the end, this money, these debates, all of this stuff, we're after those undecided voters, and you have to wonder when they'll start paying attention. And they probably won't start paying attention until the last minute.
Heath, we've said before on this show that this July 24th primary runoff is a recipe for tiny turnout. What's interesting historically about that, of course, and Buddy knows this well, too, is that midsummer runoff was always something that Georgia Democrats, who controlled the state, all of the constitutional offices, and both houses of the legislature, they loved that runoff date because they figured they could mobilize their voters, that small number of voters who were going to turn out and win runoff elections. Now it's it's not working against against Democrats right now. But the point is that was put on the map initially to help Democrats.
It really was, and normally you do have a lower turnout. But one of the things that's interesting about this summer, right, the first indications in Cobb County, where votes are higher in the first week of early voting than the actual primary. If that trend continues statewide, we may have that money in politics allows you to motivate voters to actually come to the polls. The more advertising you do, the more folks are interested in voting, and we'll see if we can break that trend.
All right, I got to get another break in. When we come back, the president is set to name his Supreme Court choice tonight at 9 p.m. We'll talk just a little bit about that, but let's talk about how the president and the White House counsel, Don McGahn, have already been able to influence the political thinking or the orientation of the 11th Circuit Court right here in Atlanta. We'll do that after this message.
On the next Fresh Air, the Omega Principle. Paul Greenberg, the award-winning author of Four Fish, writes in his new book about the science behind fish oil supplements and how the harvesting of the tiny fish who supply that and other industries is having a ripple effect, leading to less healthy and bountiful oceans. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Greg Bluestein, before we move on to a national story, you just made a comment during the break that we really want to highlight for our listeners.
Yeah, one more thing I'll be watching tonight is the most expensive gubernatorial races in Georgia have been in 2006 and 2010, which were both around $30 million. I think we could surpass that tonight or come close when all these disclosures come in, because we're about $23 million now, plus Stacey Abrams about $25 million with today's report. We might get past 30, which shows you we'll definitely surpass it by November. That just shows you about the influence of money in politics.
All right.
Is not going away.
Thank you for that. All right. We know that President Trump is going to name his Supreme Court nominee tonight. And we also know that he's been looking to appoint a conservative justice who will continue the conservative bent of the U.S. Supreme Court. Maggie Haberman reports in today's New York Times. She literally broke this story right around noon. She says that it's come down to two individuals, Brett Kavanaugh and Thomas Hardiman. Hardiman is of interest. Apparently, Heath and Buddy are really up to speed on the attorneys, the judges who are being named here. Hardiman, we are told, in part because his personal story is so meaningful to the president, right?
I think that makes a big difference. I think somebody to be on the United States Supreme Court must have experienced life. I don't think they ought to just have one government job handed to them after another. I think they need to get out there and see how the real world lives. And that's what I like about Hardiman, because whoever the president nominates is going to get confirmed. We can go through all these great stories about these Republicans peeling off and these Democrats coming in. But then the president's going to get his way on this. I don't think there's any question about this. So the real issue is who would be the best Supreme Court justice. And I personally would like to see Hardiman, even though he will not vote the way I think he ought to vote, only because he will have experienced life. The guy drove a cab to work his way through law school. That means something to me.
Well, absolutely. Look, I mean, I'm an attorney, and I grew up not very well off in South Georgia. I started working when I was 12 years old. I love the story of somebody who had to kind of work their way up. I worked and borrowed my way through law school. I've got a lot more to identify with him than I do with some of the other folks who, you know, you can't blame them if they're born with wealth or got to go to the, you know, nicest schools, you know, kind of an easy track. So I do think that appeals, and I think that it gives life experiences. And I think we've got to be careful, right, because even though we think we know how these judges are going to vote, history has taught us over the last 70 years that Democratic presidents put people on that they think are going to be liberal and they turn out to be conservative, and then Republicans put folks on the bench that they think are going to be conservative and they turn out to be moderate or liberal. So somebody with that kind of life story might be an interesting pick in that regard.
All right. But here's the interesting thing, Kevin. While the country, its attention is certainly focused on who the new Supreme Court nominee is going to be, and while there's celebration on the right that it'll be a conservative who will continue the more conservative trend in the court, and while there's dismay on the left about this, what's not getting the kind of attention that perhaps it deserves is what the Trump White House has been able to do with federal courts around the country. 99% of all cases are decided by lower courts, according to the Judicial Crisis Network, which is a conservative organization trying to get conservative judges on circuit courts around the country. In 2017, the Senate confirmed 12 of Trump's federal judge nominations, which is a record for a president in his first year. What that means is that they're already making a big impact on the direction that lower courts are moving, including right here in Atlanta, although I know in a minute Buddy Darden's going to disagree.
Well, yeah, we'll let Buddy have the floor here. But, I mean, I think what this shows is this is Republican decades-long strategy playing out. I mean, the Republicans a long time ago decided they wanted to place people on the courts. They wanted to be able to control redistricting. And so they did all the things they needed to do that. And that's where we are today. I mean, President Obama famously said elections have consequences, and he was right.
So, buddy, before we give you a chance to dissent from this, here in Georgia, in the 11th Circuit, which is Georgia, Florida, Alabama, cases come up to that circuit court from those all three of the states. They put in place Elizabeth Branch and the former Solicitor General of Alabama, Kevin Newsom. And there's a third nominee who has not yet been cleared because Jeff Flake, Republican Jeff Flake in the Senate, has put a hold on her nomination because he's concerned about the tariff
issues. Yeah, not to do with her qualifications.
Right. Doesn't have anything to do with, he's already said he thinks she's qualified and she'll eventually be confirmed. But the Constitution, U.S., I mean, the JJC believes these are very conservative judges who are going to make a difference.
Here's my point. First of all, these judges, while they are signed off on by the White House and technically appointed by the president, I've got to give Senator Isaacson and Senator Bue credit where credit is due, because these two judges, Britt Grant and, of course, now Judge Elizabeth Branch, who's already been confirmed, quite frankly, were recommended by the Georgia senators through their committee process.
Well, they're conservative senators.
They're conservative right. senators. And you would consider these two judges, these two very bright, very well-educated, very learned women judges, both of them have excellent backgrounds. And while they might be right of center, no doubt about that, at the same time, they are not what I would call right-wing fanatics by any stretch of the imagination. And one more thing, Bill, before you go, is that 11th Circuit already was the most conservative in the entire country. So nothing is being changed. It's just keeping the status quo.
Brenda, last year, the 11th Circuit Court ruled in a ruling that caught the attention of people across the country that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act does not protect gays and lesbians from discrimination in the workplace. Simultaneous to that, the circuit courts in, I think, Chicago and New York, the federal courts, took just the opposite position. So it does tell us how conservative this 11th Circuit is, whether it's...
Already.
Well, see, I'm going to say both are right.
Okay.
Both are right. As a matter of fact, 11th Circuit has ruled more conservatively more often than not. That is true. But what it does still have an impact, the fact that the president has been able to nominate and then get appointed, not just in 11th Circuit, as you mentioned, just nationwide, because it only solidifies for the next two decades at a minimum, you know, to thinking about these being lifetime appointments, the fact that it had it been in reverse, had the nominations that President Obama's nominated and actually were not appointed by the Congress, had that been the case, then there would have been a change, a slight change in our 11th Circuit. So the question is not, will they become more conservative? We do have a conservative 11th Circuit. The issue is that it could have been different, and this only basically makes it more certain.
Yeah, Kevin, you said it. Elections have consequences. Hillary Clinton would have appointed very different judges to the 11th Circuit, clearly. You know what's interesting about that, Kevin, is those folks out there who really don't like Trump, who are really dismayed by the direction the country is taking, they have been able, I mean, to an extent, those folks can sort of console themselves by saying, well, maybe we can weather the next 3 years. He could be a one-term president. When Kennedy decided to retire, it suddenly, in a sharper way than ever, hit people over the head, those who were opposed to Trump, that even if he is a one-termer, his impact on this country will extend for years to come.
Well, I think that's true, but I'll go back to what Heath said. I mean, presidents have gotten surprised in the past, and we've seen that happen on the court, where as a jurist becomes more experienced, more comfortable, older, they're not as predictable as everyone would like to believe that they are going to be.
Not always, but the consistency is still there. And what you do see, when you do see that some judges do change, as you mentioned, is, especially particularly speaking of justices, is after they've become more mature in their experience. That's when you start seeing kind of sort of an independence on how they decide to then interpret cases that come before them. But again, it's sort of going back to the issue that was said about the 11th Circuit, the same issue with the Supreme Court. We had 5-4 decisions, and it went back and forth. There's a possibility that you could convince Kennedy otherwise, but now we have more of a solidified conservative slant towards the 5-4.
And for my liberal friends out there in the listener world and the ones that I talk to all the time, there's a little consolation in here, because when you talk about a conservative judge, what the judges are saying is we're not opining on whether or not discrimination in the workplace ought to be the law. It's just not in this law now. If you want that to be the law, go back to your state legislature. Go back to the Congress. If you're a Democrat and you believe in the democratic process, you want these laws passed by the legislature, not by judges. So it doesn't in any way negate advances in the country if you have a different agenda. You just have to go back to the state legislature, and you have to go back to Congress and pass the law. Then the judges will interpret it properly.
At the Supreme Court level, that's not necessarily the case, because you're actually bringing conflicting state law. When it's a state law issue, which gives it the federal jurisdiction. And so that's what the Supreme Court ends up deciding. Where do we decide if we have one state that provides X protection or X right, but another state doesn't? And that's the cases that they're deciding. And those are the cases, even though there are less than 100 cases that they hear per term, those are the cases that are most dear and near to folks. And these are things that matter.
And that dovetails with this. I mean, the same exact thing is happening on the state level. I mean, Governor Deal's most lasting legacy might well be the judges he appoints to the state judiciary. By the time his term ends in January, he'll have appointed the majority of Georgia's Supreme Court, more than a quarter of state court of appeals judges, and more than 100 lower-level superior court and state court judges. And many of those will be in office for decades.
All right, let me take up one last issue. Very, very little time to do it, but I at least want to mention it, Greg Bluestein, because it happened since the last time we were on the air. On the 4th of July, the NAACP staged a protest at Stone Mountain demanding that the carvings of the Confederate leaders be removed. Buddy Darden referred earlier to Democrats stumbling over their own shoelaces and we know Stacey Abrams initially called for the sandblasting of those carvings. In the long run, is this a winning issue? Is this going to help Democrats get to the governor's mansion?
I think it'll energize Republicans, especially moderate Republicans who don't want to see any changes to Stone Mountain. But it also, at the same time, energizes liberal Democrats who really applaud what Stacey Abrams is saying.
There's no way around a cold, hard fact about Stone Mountain that we all have to understand as Georgians. It is the largest monument to the Confederacy in the country. And as long as monuments to the Confederacy create points of conflict and raise the ire and conflicts in our society, Stone Mountain sits there waiting to be a major, major issue for Georgia.
Absolutely. I can't emphasize that enough, right? In fact, the state bought Stone Mountain precisely as a response to Brown versus Board of Education against the civil rights movement. So when we talk about, and I do agree, we can have memorials to the Civil War that provide a historical context, but that is wholly different from glorifying the Confederacy that was basically an insurgency against these United States.
All right.
So quite different.
Brenda Lopez, you get the last word. That you win a toaster oven on today's show because we are completely out of time. And I'm glad that you did get the last word, because I want to tell you how great it was to have you back on the show. You haven't been here since you first got elected. It's wonderful. I hope you will continue to join us for a Political Rewind. Buddy Darden, you're getting fan tweets, as you always do. Thank you for being here. Heath Garrett, you know, when it's Monday, it's your day, and we're glad about that. And Greg Bluestein and Kevin Riley. Greg, you're going to be back with us on Wednesday. And speaking of Stone Mountain, once again on Wednesday, we have Michael Thurmond and Sam Olens coming in. Michael Thurmond is not going to want to talk about Stone Mountain Park because he feels he now needs to deal with it quietly. But we'll push it with him a little bit. The Republican candidates for governor are going to debate on Thursday night. The Atlanta Press Club sponsors the debate. It will be live on GPB at 7 o'clock. On Friday's show, we will be talking about that. So there's a big week ahead for Political Rewind. Kevin Riley, thank you. It's great to have you here today. You did Jim Galloway proud, Kevin.
I'm no Jim Galloway.
No, you're terrific. I'm Bill Nigut. See y'all again Wednesday at 2.